This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is the half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing once again Jesse Alston, assistant professor at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of California. We talked to him last week, and so we're going to be continuing our interview this week. So welcome, Jesse. It's good to be talking with you once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for being with us. Okay. Well, we talked about the methods that you use in gathering information about large animals, but your research is not confined just to the Sonoran Desert, is it?
No. So Arizona has a variety of habitat types. When I do U.S.-based research, I do try to work in Arizona to the extent possible. And then three of those habitat types that are locally are the Sonoran Desert at lower elevations, at kind of middle elevations that turns into more of a grassland, and then we have sort of oak and pine forests up in the skylands of the mountains. But I also do international research, especially in Kenya, and one thing that's cool about that is it's actually where I work in Kenya is a really similar landscape in a lot of ways to the Sonoran Desert. It's dry, it has two sort of rainy seasons a year that really influence the animals more than temperature between winter and fall. And a lot of the tree species are even kind of similar. So they're legumes, they're nitrogen-fixing trees, and they're either mechanically or chemically descended. So they're either kind of a little bit toxic, or at least bad-tasting, or they have spines, and so they're a little bit harder for herbivores to eat.
So what's the relationship of the Sonoran Desert to the Mojave over to the west and the Texas grasslands to the east?
Yeah, so they're pretty interesting. They do share some species, so creosote bush is really important and common species in both the Mojave Desert and the Sonoran Desert. Ocotillo is pretty common and important in both the Sonoran Desert and the Chihuahuan Desert over in New Mexico and Texas. And then if you're driving east to west or west to east on I-10, the Sonoran Desert kind of transitions to the Mojave somewhere between Gila Bend and Yuma in southwestern Arizona, and it turns into the Chihuahuan Desert kind of over on the other side of the Chiricahuas in Arizona, so around the New Mexico border.
And how far north does the Sonoran Desert extend?
So it goes up to basically the what we call the Mogollon Rim, which is an escarpment where the topography changes quite a bit over a really short area. So if you go up on the Mogollon Rim, you go up like 1,000 or 2,000 feet in elevation. Up on the top, it's the higher elevation plateau. And so what structures the Sonoran Desert is a combination of elevation, latitude, and geographical position, which changes the temperature and the amount of rainfall it gets. So as you go lower in elevation, you're hotter. As you go up in elevation, you get a little more rainfall. And so that's why the higher elevation places have grassland and forests that require a little bit more water. And as you go west, it gets drier, and that is what structures the Mojave Desert. And so really what makes the Sonoran Desert unique, so the sort of sentinel species I think of as being knowing you're in the Sonoran Desert are saguaro cacti, so the real famous giant cacti that we have in the Sonoran Desert, and also Palo Verde trees, which are really interesting trees. They have really small leaves that are drought deciduous. When it gets dry, they drop them, and when it gets wet, they leaf out again. But they photosynthesize in their bark, so their bark is just really neat shade of green, and so they deal really well with drought. And so if you see one of those two species, you have a pretty good idea you're in the Sonoran Desert. And the Sonoran Desert is often called the wettest desert in the world.
Oh, really?
And that really shapes its unique and really high levels of biodiversity. And so we have two rainy seasons. The monsoon season in the summer is about where we get about 60% of our rain for the year, and then there's a rainy season in the winter. We get about 30% of our rain for the year. And these pulses of rain and precipitation, they make the Sonoran Desert can be really, really green at times if we've had good rains. And because we get these good rains sometimes, we get a tremendous amount of plant species in particular, but it's also one of the most biodiverse places in the country for all kinds of wildlife species, which we can talk about a little bit later in the interview.
So what mammals have you spent the most effort studying and finding interesting information?
So I'm just getting my research program started here down in Arizona, but where I focus my effort on getting things started is partially on big game animals. So the Sonoran Desert has some really unique species or subspecies that we can't just take research that was performed in places north of the Sonoran Desert and assume that even if it's the same species, that the Sonoran Desert subspecies will behave similarly because it's such a different landscape. So some of these would be coos deer or cow's deer, which is a really small white-tailed deer, desert bighorn sheep, which is a little bit different than the Rocky Mountain bighorns that you find across most of the western United States, Sonoran pronghorn, so that's another slightly different subspecies of pronghorn from the ones you see in Colorado or Wyoming and Montana, and then javelinas, which you really only get in Arizona, a little bit in New Mexico, and some in Texas.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the javelinas. Do they contribute to the ecosystem?
Yeah, they're probably pretty important seed dispersers. So they really like eating cacti, especially prickly pears. And so they probably do quite a bit eating fruit, transmitting those across the landscape. And prickly pears can also reproduce without seeds. So if you cut off a prickly pear pad, throw it on the ground, and it gets enough water, it'll set roots and send up a little clone. So javelinas may spread prickly pears a little bit that way. They also do a lot of rooting. And I haven't seen studies on this, but species that dig around and disturb the soil are often pretty important for their ecosystems.
And there are coatis down there, too.
Yeah, coatis.
And ringtails.
Yeah.
What's unique about they're in a class called procyonids, right?
Right.
And what's unique about them?
Yeah, so coatis are kind of like a long-nosed raccoon. And so you'll find these mostly around water. So they tend to be, you see them most around the mountains around here because there's often more permanent water in the mountains because there's a little more rainfall. They're really social species. They're omnivores. They eat all kinds of stuff. And the two fun facts about those are that they are a species, along with javelinas, that are really moving northward pretty fast. So javelinas actually colonized Arizona relatively recently. If you look at trash heaps from Native American villages hundreds of years ago, you don't see bones from javelinas. They started appearing in those trash heaps not that long ago, only several hundred years ago, not like thousands of years. And so that's really interesting. And coatis are doing that too. And so historically they were, you know, a real southern Arizona species, but now you might even see them up around Flagstaff when you're getting up into ponderosa pine forests that are a lot more like what you'd see in the more northerly western states.
So you mentioned pronghorn. How does Sonoran pronghorn differ from other pronghorn to the north?
So they're not that much different in appearance. If I gave the readers photos of pronghorn and you couldn't really see background, you might have a hard time telling the Sonoran pronghorn from the pronghorn elsewhere, but they may be a little bit ganglier, a little bit sleeker, and they're really good at dealing with heat and water limitations. So the Sonoran Desert is really hot. There's not much water in it, and so they're kind of uniquely adapted to deal with those. Unfortunately, they're an endangered subspecies. There's only a few hundred individuals in southwestern Arizona and in Sonora. So they're not hunted like the other pronghorn, and they're really reliant on annuals. And so of the various types of plants, there's really two strategies in dry places like the Sonoran Desert, really everywhere, but it becomes really important in the Sonoran Desert where there aren't that many resources for a plant to grow fast. You can either grow really, really fast and try to produce seeds as quickly as possible before you dry out, or you can take longer to get established but, you know, live much longer. And so those species that live much longer tend to have spines. They tend to be really chemically defended, like creosote bush. If you ate creosote bush, it tastes really bad. It tastes really chemically. And so the annual plants that really tend to shoot up right after rains during the monsoon season and the winter rains, those annuals are really important for species like Sonoran pronghorn and desert pronghorn that we'll be talking about because they're putting their investment in growing and producing seeds as fast as possible. So they have nice tender leaves. They're not putting a lot of resources in the chemical defense or spines or things like that. And so they're really important for the herbivores in the Sonoran Desert.
Did you say there are only 200 of them in the Sonoran?
Yeah, something in that ballpark.
Where are they found? Where are they found?
It fluctuates from year to year, depending on drought. But that's a reasonable estimate.
And where are they found?
So there are a couple populations in southwestern Arizona. So one kind of around Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge. That's where most of them are. And then there's a few in the Vico Valley, which is Sonoran Desert National Monument. And then there's also a population down in Sonora.
Do they migrate across the border into Mexico?
Historically, they may well have, but there's two real big barriers right now, so we don't see that much movement across the border with the border wall, and then also there's a highway that runs just south of the border wall, east-west across northern Mexico. And,
yeah.
They have a hard time crossing both of those simultaneously.
So is the population stabilized, or is it diminishing or increasing?
It's generally increasing, but slowly. So there's good biologists in both Arizona and Sonora working really hard to bring the population back, playing a really active role in their management. And it's pretty painstaking progress, but there's more and more pronghorn. Maybe not every year, because we get a bad drought year and the population will go down a little bit, but the trend over time is definitely going upwards.
Are the desert bighorn found in the same area as the pronghorn?
Yeah, so they're a little bit more widespread. So there's desert bighorn sheep in California, Nevada as well. But definitely, I think the bulk of them are probably in western and southern Arizona, to my knowledge at least.
And how do the desert bighorn differ from Rocky Mountain bighorn?
Again, they're kind of similar to the pronghorn, that they're maybe a little bit ganglier. They're really specialized to deal with heat and water limitations. So desert bighorn sheep in particular, I mean, they can go, if it's during the cool season and there's good forage, they basically never have to drink water. They can produce enough of it from their forage that they're really, really able to deal without water. And that's really important because they're really vulnerable to predation by mountain lions. You know, a lot of folks think that predators have really big impacts on game populations. And I tend to be pretty skeptical when folks say that there's some sort of predatory limitation. It's not people. People tend to kill a lot more animals than the wild predators do. But desert bighorn sheep are definitely a case where the predators, especially mountain lions, can have really, really big impacts on populations, especially really small, isolated populations.
Have any jaguar been seen in the U.S. in recent years?
So I can't remember the exact number right now, but we have either three or four. So one or two new ones showed up in the past year. There have been one or two floating around for a while. And when they show up, they're all right near the border. So I think the ones we have now are in the Chiricahua Mountains and the Huachuca Mountains, which the Huachucas are right down on the border. But there was one seen in the Whetstones, or caught on camera in the Whetstones in the past year. The Whetstones are fairly northerly for jaguar sightings in Arizona.
Are more jaguar found south of the border?
Yeah, for sure. So jaguars are primarily a Central and South American species. And so they're a little isolated. The bigger populations are kind of isolated these days, but for the more northerly populations, their stronghold is definitely in Sonora. The ones that we get in Arizona tend to be juvenile males, so they're dispersing, looking for a place to call their own, and so they'll come up into Arizona. There's enough resources for them to get by, but then when they become full adults and want to mate, there won't be any females around, and they'll typically cross back down. So we had a real famous jaguar about a decade ago named El Jefe, and he showed up north of the border, was there for a while. Everybody's really excited, and he kind of disappeared for a while, and he showed up really far down in southern Sonora and seems to have made his permanent adult abode down there.
Is there any problem of genetic collapse due to such a tiny population?
There could be. I mean, Arizona's really interesting because the jaguars were probably always pretty rare, and there may not even been a true breeding population in Arizona historically. So we know some reproduction happens. You know, we know that females with cubs were killed at times in the 1800s and very early 1900s. But they're always quite rare in Arizona. The Mexico and places even further south have always been their stronghold where you get jaguars in really dense populations.
How about ocelot?
So ocelots are kind of in the same boat as jaguars as far as they're mostly a Central American species. And their habitat is really thick brush, even in the places that are more deserty. So they do really well in the jungle, the true kind of rainforest in Central America. But they also do pretty well in what's called the desert thorn scrub habitat, which superficially looks like the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, but it's the brush is a lot thicker. And so when they show up in Arizona, they typically, they're like the jaguars, where they show up kind of in the mountains, often around streams.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, to my knowledge, we have one ocelot that we know of. We've gotten photos of it in the Huachuca Mountains. Again, it's a male, but it's been around for a while, so we know it's an adult. And these are, they're like jaguars. They're a solitary carnivore, but they're much smaller, so like sort of similar in size to a house cat. They're more like a bobcat, whereas the jaguar is even bigger than a mountain lion.
And Margay and Jaguarundi, they're extinct now in the U.S.?
Yeah, so there's sightings, especially of Jaguarundis, that get reported every year in Arizona, but there, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a confirmed sighting of either of those species. There are definitely people that report them, and it's not too crazy to think that they might show up here, especially a dispersing male, but they're even more kind of jungle restricted species than jaguars and ocelots are.
And bobcat and cougar, those are the more dominant or frequent species in the area.
Yeah, they're both really common across the Sonoran Desert. So an example I often give, so I spent a lot of time in the woods in my life, pretty much all of it in places where there's bobcats around. I've seen 5 total. 3 of those have been in the Tucson area, where I've only been around for about 2 years. So I've seen 2 in town in Tucson, and then 1 kind of on the outskirts when I was going out for a hike. So 60% of the bobcats I've seen have been in, you know, less than 10% of my life, and less than 10% of my time in the woods, probably. And the neat thing about Tucson's bobcats is they do really well in the urban environment. And so there's a really interesting project that was started by some folks who retired from Arizona Game and Fish a few years ago. They got an itch to do some research, started up the Bobcats in Tucson project, and they found bobcats were doing really well in places that were pretty urban. They found bobcat kittens that had been deposited on people's roofs, and these weren't, you know, crazy, really geometric roofs with all these nips and crannies. Pretty standard roof. A bobcat mom just threw her kittens up there. And the homeowners had no idea until the researchers knocked on the door and were like, hey, there's a bobcat on your roof. Like, be careful with your dogs and that sort of thing. And so I would highly encourage folks listening now to check out the Bobcats in Tucson project. You can find it on Google pretty easily.
And what's the incidence of mountain lion?
They're also, mountain lions are much less common in general than bobcats, but in Arizona, especially in really rugged areas, higher elevation areas, if you're out hiking in a mountain range in Arizona, there's going to be pumas around. And so they're also a little bit more urban than you would think. They're really stealthy, so you don't typically see them very often. But there was one that showed up, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, at one of the hospitals in Tucson. I was just hanging out in the courtyard. Arizona Game and Fish came and relocated it. And so there have been folks who have put remote cameras in the washes that go through Tucson, so our dry rivers that funnel rain out of the city, and they'll get mountain lions in there from time to time. I wouldn't be surprised if they were in people's backyards occasionally. And so I've actually got a research project dealing with urban wildlife, and I'm hoping to get a better feel for how many there are in urban Tucson specifically.
And those cats can withstand the hot weather, is that right?
Yeah, they seem to do just fine in the hot weather. I will say that one thing, so that you can't, you know, jaguars and ocelots are listed under the Endangered Species Act, so there's no hunting of those. And actually, you know, if you're doing hunting or trapping in ways that might endanger those species, there's special restrictions for places where you might catch those. You can't use certain traps.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that. But bobcats are trapped sometimes, and then cougar, or pumas in particular, are hunted. I would encourage readers to listen to the Arizona Wildlife Federation had a recent podcast where they interviewed a mountain lion hunter. And I thought the podcast was really interesting because not a type of hunting that I had been exposed to. It's very different than basically how any other species I'm aware of is hunted. But it was really enlightening to listen to that podcast.
And tell me about Mexican wolves. Are there many of those? What, in New Mexico or?
Yeah, so the U.S. population is up on the Mogollon Rim country in Arizona and New Mexico. They kind of straddle the border there. And historically, the Mogollon Rim was the dividing line between Mexican wolf habitat and sort of central Rocky Mountain wolf habitat. So Mexican wolves are a little bit smaller, so they're eating mostly javelina and coos deer historically. And those are, you know, smaller subspecies. They're only 50 to 100 pounds often, whereas, you know, wolves north of Arizona or in northern Arizona were eating more elk and larger deer. So big mule deer, you know, can be 200 pounds or more. And so the Mexican wolf was a smaller population, but the ungulate densities and wilderness area were largest on the Mogollon Rim, and so that's the reintroduction area. They actually went extinct in the wild. The last handful were trapped, captive bred, and then reintroduced. And they chose that Mogollon Rim country around the Gila River headwaters because that was the biggest stretch of wilderness, so the wolves would not get poached or interact with humans that much. There is a population in Sonora, so there's mountain ranges in Sonora that are really similar to the ones in southern Arizona. Both of these populations seem to be growing, but we have a really good handle on the population numbers in the U.S. We have a less good handle on the populations in Sonora because the area that is best wolf habitat tends to be actually run by the cartel. Mm-hmm. So in some ways it benefits wolves because it keeps out folks, but in other ways it makes it, you know, really hard for biologists. The cartel doesn't really want biologists sipping around in their strongholds.
Yeah. How about you? I assume you have an abundance of coyotes. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I think it was about a month ago, my wife was out walking her dog and saw a coyote run through our neighborhood. And so coyotes do really well in urban areas. They're even more so than bobcats. So they're omnipresent.
Uh-huh. And foxes?
Yeah, so we have two foxes in the Sonoran Desert. We have gray foxes and kit foxes. So gray foxes are pretty common, but you don't see them that often. They're pretty secretive. But kit foxes are a lot rarer. They basically live where coyotes don't live, or coyote densities are really low because there's not much prey. So the coyotes really seem to control their populations. They're a lot more sensitive to humans than gray foxes or coyotes are. So actually, a big concern for kit foxes right now is energy development. So we're installing a bunch of solar arrays out on the landscape in the desert. And so one thing that a lot of the government biologists are really interested in is making sure that those solar arrays don't go in places where there are good populations of kit foxes, so we're not reducing their populations.
So are skunks abundant down there?
Yeah. In southeastern Arizona, I think we're the only place that has four skunk species. So we've got striped skunks, which are pretty common all across the U.S., western spotted skunks, which are really rare, but which are kind of only in the southern Arizona, some in southern New Mexico and Texas kind of area. And then we've also got a fourth species, the hooded skunk, which is hognose and hooded skunks are mostly Mexican species that poke up in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So how many species of bats do you have down on the Sonoran?
I think there are places in southeastern Arizona where you can catch 24 species, which is the highest bat biodiversity of anywhere in the country. So if you're a bat biologist, you can catch more species down here in southeastern Arizona than anywhere else.
Really?
And not only can you catch more species, but we have at kind of a higher taxonomic level, there's more variation. So most places in the U.S. Have only vespertilionate bats, which look a lot like mice with wings. So they have, their noses are really simple. Whereas in southeastern Arizona, we have a few philostomid bats. And so these are the ones you see in in Central South America that have really interesting skin flaps on their nose. They don't really look like anything but bats. We also have molossids, which are really interesting bats. Their facial structure is usually pretty simple. They can have mouths that look kind of like a bulldog mouth, but they're really built for speed, and they're really high, fast flyers typically. They echolocate really loudly, so some species humans can actually hear echolocating. They're a low enough register that humans can hear it, and they're really, you know, really fast, kind of the jet airplanes of bats.
And white nose syndrome, is that just affecting certain species?
So white nose syndrome mostly affects, or it really only affects species that hibernate. We definitely have bats in southern Arizona that do hibernate. We also have some species that are migratory, but we haven't had white nose pop up yet in southern Arizona. It may come around eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something we're trying to collect baseline data on now to see, to get a better handle when it does pop up, what it's doing to some of our unique bat species.
Mm-hmm. So, Jesse, did I miss anything?
I don't think so. I guess one bat that I will talk about just briefly is a really cool bat. It's one of the Philostoma bats that I mentioned earlier with really interesting facial features. And that's the lesser long-nosed bat, Leptonycteris yerbabuenae. So it's really famous because it's the bat species that is nectarivorous. So it drinks nectar. It's really tightly associated with agaves, which is what tequila is made out of. And so if you like tequila or mezcal, then these are the bats for you. They also are in Arizona part of the year, and then they migrate down to Mexico for other parts of the year. But when they're in Arizona, they also drink a lot out of bird feeders. So certain times of the year, you can fill up your hummingbird feeder at night, and they'll drain it by the morning.
Wow.
They're a really interesting species, and I've seen there'll be some folks wait out by their hummingbird feeders around dusk with their cameras and try to get it, you know, the background against the sky and take really cool videos of bats drinking out of their hummingbird feeders.
So is the Sonoran Desert a wildlife paradise?
Yeah, I think so. We only talked about the mammals today. The other Sonoran Desert animals are pretty unique too, and also real hotspots of biodiversity. So if for, you know, most of the listeners of this show are really interested in wildlife, if you want to see really cool mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, we have a pretty amazing variety down here.
Uh-huh. That's great. Well, thank you very much. This has been a great interview. So thanks. Really appreciate your spending time with us. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Yeah, really enjoyed it.
So our guest today has been Jesse Alston. He's assistant professor at School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can see our website at js-wilderness.com. So thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.